Continuing education credits for physicians and other healthcare professionals is provided by VCU Healthcare Continuing Education. Check out cribsiders.vcuhealth.org for more information.
The Cribsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and informational purposes only. The views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host.
Welcome back to the Cribsiders!
Ahoy.
Justin Burke joined tonight with Dr. Sam Mazur, Dr. Chris Tchoumenchou. Not tonight, it's 3 p.m. This is a unique recording for us. what a great episode. Guys, welcome. Say hi. How's it going?
What's up, yo?
Hey, everybody.
We had a great talk tonight with our guest, Dr. Sriram Ramgopal. He is here to discuss hypothermic infants. A lot of great pearls, a very fascinating field. Before we go into the content, hey, Chris, can you remind us about the show?
Sure. We are the Pediatric Medicine Podcast. We interview leading experts in the fields to bring you clinical pearls, practice-changing knowledge, and answer lingering questions about core topics in pediatric medicine.
We have a fantastic conversation with our guest, Dr. Ramgopal. He's a specialist in pediatric emergency medicine at Lurie Children's Hospital. He's excited about using data science and predictive modeling to address a variety of problems pertaining to the care of children in the acute care setting. In this case, his specific areas of focus include evaluating socioeconomic disparities in care delivery, the care of hypothermic young infants, and the care of children by emergency medical services.
He teaches us what we do and don't know about hypothermic infants, when and why to be reassured when swaddling fits is the low temperature, how to pursue a differential diagnosis of hypothermia, and why the hypothermic sepsis patient is a diagnosis you definitely don't want to miss.
Everyone needs to catch this episode because it's hot, 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 or cold. I don't know. Nah, I screwed it up. I don't know.
But yeah.
We'll go with it. Should we'll be more fevers. Oh, well.
Yeah. Send in your puns. Dr. Sriram Ramgopal, thank you for joining us. Welcome to the Cribsiders.
Thanks for having me today.
We're very excited to have you. We're very excited to talk about this topic. Before we dive into content, we'd love to know you a bit better. But first, also ask, we're an informal group. Can we call you Ram throughout the show?
That sounds awesome.
Beautiful. Ram, I'd love to get to know you a little bit better. Can you tell us a little bit about a one-liner about yourself and maybe something you're excited about outside of medicine?
Sure, Justin. Can anyone be excited about anything outside of medicine? I'm not sure. But I am a pediatric emergency medicine attending. I've been at Lurie Children's Hospital for 5 years. I'm excited about all things prediction modeling, including the management of hypothermic infants like we're going to talk about here. Outside of work, I love Nintendo. I'm married to a wife who's a geriatrician, and I have 3 girls.
Love it. The predictive modeling thing, I have recently gone down a deep spiral of machine learning with ChatGPT, which I realize is a very annoying kind of finance bro thing to say. But you can learn so much data analysis and coding and machine learning just by talking to ChatGPT and it uploading some Excel data. It's bonkers. Wave of the future.
Proceed with caution, but it has become my best friend when coding.
Yeah, troubleshooting is amazing.
All right, my question, I'm going to go off script because I heard something. So what is your favorite Nintendo game right now?
I am very loyal to Mario and Zelda games. And even though they're a little bit easy, I still really like a good classic Mario platformer.
Nice, nice.
Yeah.
We're a big Mario and Zelda family as well. And my oldest and I, who's 12, we recently just watched on YouTube a documentary on how they developed the original Legend of Zelda game and how they developed at the same time as the Super Mario Brothers video game. It was an hour and a half of video game documentary that my 12-year-old absolutely loved. So you should check it out.
That sounds like bliss to me.
Warmer, sunnier days are calling, Cribsetters listeners. Fuel up for them with Factor's no prep, no mess meals. The key to Factor is they have dietitian-approved meals that can be ready in just 2 minutes. No matter how busy you are in the clinic, hospital, or at home, Factor has delicious meals for you. Choose between 35 different meals and more than 60 add-ons every week between the different meal options such as Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, and Keto. So, Cribsetters listeners, treat yourself to restaurant-quality meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, and blackened salmon by heading to factormeals.com/cribsetters50 and use code CRIBSIDERS50 to get 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next month. That's code CRIBSIDERS50 at factormeals.com/CRIBSIDERS50 to get 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next month while your subscription is still active.
Yeah, absolutely. And I actually do think this is a good segue because that point is going to come up a couple times as we talk about this case. So we're going to start with Stone Cold Steve. We'll hold his last name for copyright purposes. So he's a 5-day-old X-36-week infant who presents to his pediatrician's office for his first newborn visit. He was born at 36-1 via spontaneous vaginal delivery. Steve's birth weight was over 2 kilograms, and so he was able to go to the newborn nursery, where he was discharged on day of life 3 without any complication. So at this first office visit, he was found to be 35.8 degrees Celsius or 96.4 degrees Fahrenheit rectally despite multiple measurements, and so he was referred to the emergency room for further management. Per his parents, it's hard to tell if he's been acting any differently. You know, he's only 3 days old. He feeds every 2 to 3 hours, has consistent urine and stool output, and cries as expected. So we're going to start real basic here. We all feel comfortable that 38°C or 100.4 degrees Fahrenheit is a fever. But what is considered hypothermic for this age group? And is there even a consensus definition?
That is a great question. And I think that is going to color the rest of this conversation, in that all the literature that proceeds from this conversation will have different cutoff definitions for hypothermia. And you have to keep that in mind when reading those various papers. There is not a clear consensus for what truly is or is not hypothermia. So the WHO has guidelines for neonates, and they define anything less than 36.5 as being hypothermic. That's degrees centigrade. That is a pretty high cutoff, in my opinion, but nevertheless, it correlates with the severity of illness among patients throughout the world from a global perspective who are encountering any type of healthcare setting. The Goldstein criteria for SIRS, which stands for the Systemic Inflammatory Response Syndrome, is pretty old. It dates to 2005, and they use the definition of less than 36 degrees centigrade as part of the criteria for SIRS. And then they say if a patient has SIRS criteria and suspicion for infection, that patient meets criteria for sepsis. So you see 36 and 36.5 thrown out a lot most frequently. There's environmental definitions for hypothermia that go even lower, including as low as 35.5 as the starting cutoff. We're not going to be talking, I think, much about environmental hypothermia. Like, that's like a baby that was left out in the cold for a prolonged period of time in the snow or something like that. But outside of that, you see 36 and 36.5 most frequently. We recently did a survey that was published in Pediatrics, where we literally just asked clinicians what they thought of as their cutoff for hypothermia, and less than or equal to 36.0 seems to be the consensus.
I think that's really helpful. And I will say, you know, in starting to kind of approach this, a child with maybe a temperature under 36, like Stone Cold Steve is 35.8, you know, 35.9. A lot of times I feel like in the emergency room or in the clinic, a nurse will come and say, hey, this baby's temperature was really low, but it's cold in there, so we swaddled him and warmed him up. I almost always associate, you know, a low temperature as being, quote, environmental. But I admit that's something that just seems so absurd to me to say, like, oh, the fact that he's not wearing a blanket is why a very skilled nurse is getting a quite abnormal temperature. Can you talk a little bit about what is this, like, just environmental hypothermia and the swaddling or, you know, increasing the heat in the room that dramatically affect a baby's temperature?
I think that does. Neonates and young infants are particularly poorly suited towards adapting themselves to cold environments. And so that degree of thermoregulation is often lacking. A smaller baby specifically will have less fat, and so less ability to maintain that degree of homeostasis that's essential for normal bodily function. So there is some degree of truth to that statement, where if a baby has been exposed in clinic and you know, the nurse is getting all the other vitals first and gets the temperature last while the baby's completely naked with just a diaper on, that baby is more likely to just have that potentially spurious measurement in their temperature where it's just low. You redress the baby, bundle them back up, and the temperature goes back up. Whether or not that baby requires a workup, I think the jury is still out. I'm sure we'll get into this further, but I think that temperature needs to be considered in context with other things. And I think there is something that remains to be said about the judgment of the physician that's taking care of that baby, because the science is showing that we are working up babies that look sicker. So there's something about that clinician examination beyond just the temperature alone that's raising concern for sepsis in the babies that are getting worked up for it.
And so this is actually a great start about talking about what you need for the workup, what doesn't. Before we even get into the further workup and what you're concerned about, I thought we'd start kind of big picture and start talking about what's the differential diagnosis for temperature instability in the neonate. You know, we just talked about one, but I was wondering if you can kind of walk through your differential even before we get to trying to work up and determine between each of these pieces.
Absolutely. I think this is interesting because a lot of the conversation about hypothermia extends or is sort of the sequel to a lot of fantastic, often high quality prospective research that's been done for febrile infants. And in the world of febrile infants, we really think about potentially serious bacterial infections. And so you'll see acronyms like SBI or IBI thrown around a lot. And just to make sure this is clear for beginners, IBI refers to invasive bacterial infections, that is bacterial meningitis and bacteremia, and SBI adds urinary tract infection onto that. So these are all very serious infections that can occur in a baby with fever, even if a UTI is missed, and a UTI is for sure the least severe of those three diagnoses, that can have very serious implications for that child's outcome. And so when we're taking care of a febrile infant, the focus is really on those three infections and really especially focusing on bacteremia and bacterial meningitis with the more recent febrile infant guidelines. So that is the focus with febrile infants. When we start thinking about hypothermic infants, we want to think the same way. When I was a trainee, we'd think of hypothermia as quote unquote temperature instability. And a lot of our diagnostic workup would proceed along that pathway of, okay, it's kind of like a fever, even though it's not a fever, let's do the same workup for that baby. And that workup might involve getting urine cultures, blood cultures, and CSF cultures, among other things. And then if the infant is in the right age group or looking potentially worrisome, giving empiric antibiotics or admission based on the guidelines we had during my fellowship and which have continued to evolve. When you're talking about hypothermic infants, those infections can be a cause of a low temperature, and we do find that for infants who have one of those infections, they tend to be colder, that is, have a lower minimum temperature during their hospitalization or emergency department stay compared to babies who do not have one of those infections. But hypothermia is caused by so many other things. So fever in a neonate is not being caused by like thyroid storm or like a different type of autoimmune process. You know, really, you're just talking about those bacterial infections and viral infections. With hypothermic infants, the can of worms is much bigger. And so when you're thinking about these babies in the emergency department or in the in-hospital setting, you need to think about those as well. We have looked at a large sample of infants to see what potential diagnoses outside of SBI and IBI are popping out. A good number of them just have this as a finding, and it's like a whatever finding. You know, it's just a disturbance of temperature regulation. Like, what does that mean? Nobody really knows, but the baby seems fine. Let's move on with our lives. A lot of these babies have some degree of hyperbilirubinemia. I think that's probably going to be around 1/5 to 1/3. Prematurity occurs in a fairly high proportion, depending on what study you're looking at. That's also about 1/5 to 1/3. When you get to older infants with hypothermia, you're looking at things like bronchiolitis. Congenital hypertrophic pyloric stenosis can occur in some of these because of that correlation with malnutrition. Those babies are losing calories. They can't maintain their temperature. Respiratory failure, any type of respiratory illness, those things can also start to play a role. It ends up being a little bit more complicated than simply looking at whether or not they have a presumed viral infection or a serious bacterial or invasive bacterial infection.
So I just wanted to summarize for a second, because I just think this is good and we should just ask a little bit more for some differential pieces. So it sounds like we're talking about invasive or serious bacterial infection is one of them, including and viral infections as well. We talked about kind of this temperature instability, or this temperature thing that we don't know what it means, but we're going to call it for us. We've kind of been referring to it as this environmental piece. We've talked about being premature and, you know, not having much fat, being very small, and that kind of goes along with that those lines as well. And then we started to talk a little bit about poor weight gain and hypertrophic pyloric stenosis and talking about kind of abnormal weight there. Are there any other things that we need to think of when we think of like metabolic stuff? Like people will just give you that metabolic anything and you're like, oh no, what do I send? You know, before we even get into those testings, should those things be on the differential or not really?
When we have done our analysis with this, medically complex conditions such as metabolic conditions or congenital cardiac diseases do pop up. They are not very common. You know, you're talking about things that occur in, you know, single digits, 0.x% type of frequency. I don't think there's enough information to know which babies should really be worked up for those types of conditions and which babies should not. Certainly a lot of congenital cardiac diseases are being picked up in the perinatal period or in the prenatal period. So oftentimes that's a known thing when the patient comes into the emergency department or if they're admitted to the hospital and they have this hypothermic finding. Other conditions occur with such degree of infrequency, it's hard to know when exactly you should be concerned. I think, again, there is something about the evaluation of an experienced clinician, like something is off with this baby. I'm a little bit more worried about this one compared to the other one I saw last week, is still going to be important in the absence of reliable data.
Yeah, and I think this is fascinating. We'll take a deep dive on the other differential. That I know that you and your team have this beautiful pediatrics research paper that we'll have in the show notes as well. Before diving into that, I wondered if there's any understanding of when a patient with a when a kiddo with SIRS or with a kid with sepsis, when one presents with fever versus presenting with hypothermia, is there any thought? Is a patient that maybe is even clearly bacteremic and has sepsis, but is presenting with hypothermia as opposed to fever, are there known differences between those two types of phenotypes or an understanding of why one might present with elevated temperature as opposed to reduced temperature?
There's not a good answer that specifically pertains to young infants. There's a larger body of research that has looked at the presence of hypothermia in the presence of sepsis more often in adults than anybody else. And you find that in some situations, hypothermia is almost a perversion of the normal inflammatory cascade, or potentially could occur as a late response to sepsis. What I can tell you is that while we believe, based on the existing literature, which I think certainly has its limitations, we believe that serious bacterial infections occur less frequently in hypothermic infants compared to febrile infants, we do know that when it happens, it is a lot worse, and that patients who have hypothermic sepsis sustain a higher degree of mortality compared to febrile infants with it. And whether or not this represents like the terminal end of the inflammatory cascade, like the body has tried all these other things and now it's just sort of thermoregulation is starting to shut down, or whether it's due to some other cause, I think I can only speculate. And maybe there's a more nuanced answer somewhere out there in the literature that I'm not familiar with. But I think this is where it gets interesting, where while the chance of there being a serious infection or sepsis is lower, the cost of missing it is potentially higher.
So my next question actually is, with this differential that we just talked about, does it start to change when we talk about gestational age of the infant? So if we have a, 25-weeker versus we have a complete full-term infant, and or if it's farther in their days of life?
This is really interesting, and I think the statistics make it hard to understand this topic. Gestational age and age of the baby all kind of run together to some extent. So we are all probably somewhat familiar with this certain phenotype of infant who maybe is late preterm, like the baby in this case that we're talking about here, who's hypothermic, whose mom's milk hasn't come in, and they're not feeding very well for that reason. They're not doing any supplementation, so the baby's just not getting enough volume and not getting enough calories. Because of their prematurity, they're small relative to a term baby, and so they just don't have as much fat stores. And so they just cannot maintain their temperature, even though there's nothing otherwise wrong with that baby. So that is very common, and I've seen that a lot, and I think that happens more often than not with these hypothermic babies. They just need a little bit of help, maybe some supplementation, maybe they need to be watched in the hospital or not, but they'll be okay. They don't have anything more sinister going on. So that baby tends to be overwhelmingly the majority of babies who have hypothermia in the emergency department. And so like everything else in pediatrics, it's all about trying to find that needle in the haystack and saying, oh, of all those babies, which one do I think has sepsis? Or which one do I think has something more awful going on? And when you look at the research that has tried to evaluate that role of prematurity in predictive models for hypothermia, again, you're talking about retrospective studies, and I have concerns about ascertainment bias in my own work as well as other published work too. But there seems to be some association with a slightly older age range and the presence of sepsis or a serious bacterial infection. You know, we're not talking about very old babies, but babies that are a little bit more than a week old tend to be at higher risk of having a more severe type of infection compared to younger babies. Now, whether or not that's just a statistical piece of noise because the babies in the younger age group are just being flooded out by this phenotype of otherwise fine babies who are premature and need help gaining weight is hard to really pull out. When you look at specifically the role of prematurities with the association of SBI or IBI, I'm familiar with two studies that have done this. One study was done by our own group. It's a four-site retrospective multicenter study. That study found a negative correlation between the presence of prematurity and the presence of a serious bacterial infection. I think, again, it's because of that fact that prematurity means that the baby was probably younger when they came to the emergency department, and those babies oftentimes are just fine. They just are basically a failure to thrive type of phenotype, and they're cold because of that. Another study that involved 10 hospitals of babies that were in multiple settings, including in the in-hospital and ED setting, found that prematurity in a univariable analysis was positively associated with the presence of an IBI. So the jury, I think, is still out, and I think that confounder with age is going to be hard to disentangle.
So now that we've talked about, you know, what we sort of feel is the definition of hypothermia, we've looked at the risk factors and also even looked at what our differential is. Now I'm sort of scared, especially since I'm so used to seeing febrile infants, and now we're talking about hypothermia. Help us, when you have this type of patient show up in the emergency department, do you have a systematic approach? What do you do? What are the specific things you always ask the parents, and how do you go about and assess these patients?
So I think this is sort of the systematic approach we have for any neonate or young infant that we're evaluating in the emergency department. So the amount of history you'll be able to get, since the baby is young, is going to be a little bit limited. You're going to get that pregnancy history, type of delivery, age of the baby, of course. You want to know if there are any potential maternal risk factors, like if the mom was group B strep positive or if they were appropriately treated for that infection. One would postulate that the presence of any stay in the neonatal ICU might correspond to a higher risk of SBI. That at least is a plausible thing that one would want to know about, even if it hasn't really borne out much in the work that's been done so far. Any previously diagnosed medical conditions that the baby might have had. I mean, things will certainly change if the baby has a known congenital cardiac disease, to reference a previous part of this discussion. When you get to your physical examination, it's going to be the same way you examine any baby. And prior work has shown that we're not very good at examining babies. And that's unfortunately the fact of the matter. There's been great research in febrile infants that show that clinician gestalt is pretty limited when we're evaluating febrile infants, and that our suspicion for which babies are sick and not sick doesn't really correspond too well with whether or not they have a serious bacterial infection. When you're talking about a hypothermic infant, I think it gets even more tricky, because all hypothermic infants are a little bit cool and clamped down. Their perfusion might be limited just by a factor of their temperature alone. They might be a little bit bradycardic, again, because their temperatures are running low. Those are all things that in any situation would be a red flag. You know, if the baby's poorly perfused, if they have bradycardia relative to their age, that would be a red flag. I would also want to know about how the baby's feeding. That could be potentially relevant. If there's concern that the baby is not feeding well, that certainly could play a role into why they are presenting to you in the first place, especially if they seem like they're relatively small for their age, or it could be a factor that's associated with sepsis. If you have a serious bacterial infection, even if it's just a urinary tract infection, you're not going to feed well because you don't feel so good. But I think that's another useful data point too. We have looked at the role of physical examination with these babies in one predictive model that we've put out. It doesn't seem to have a good association with the presence of a serious bacterial infection, which was the outcome in that study. In one great retrospective study that was published by Kazmaier and colleagues, they found 3 patients who had a serious bacterial infection. All of them had something wrong with them. They had apnea or poor feeding. So I think there's still some value in looking into these things, even if their predictive value is not great. We've also published a case series of infants that has suggested that, you know, in the sample of approximately 20 infants, about half of them had something wrong with their physical examination. Like they were lethargic, that is lethargic as defined by the clinician. They had some degree of apnea or poor feeding. So I think there's still some merit to these, even if they don't shake out in these big predictive models as being quote unquote significant. Again, I've talked about this a few times earlier in this conversation, but as the clinician on the spot trying to make a decision, if you think a baby is sick, then the predictive model doesn't matter anymore. It's useless to you, right? You know, so you're going to do everything you can so that you can sleep well at night and knowing that you did what you needed to do for that baby. So if the baby is not feeding well or has poor perfusion, regardless of its predictive value for sepsis in that baby, you should still do what you need to do and not rely on any other predictive model.
It sounds like in a lot of these cases, it's really, you know, the hypothermia plus. If they're hypothermic and lethargic, or hypothermic and having feeding difficulties, hypothermic and having some respiratory issues, that can really point to a flag that this needs to be taken seriously. And I think, as you mentioned, that the biggest challenge is you don't want to miss a bad infection because it can be so severe. What's the role of blood work? I imagine if I were in the ED, that would be something that would be very reassuring if we had a normal CBC, a normal procalcitonin or CRP or bili, if there's the hyperbilirubinemia is coming up a lot. Is there kind of a general workup that you typically do? Are there other things like this procalcitonin or something that might be helpful that you as an expert would often use? And not to do a shotgun question, have a follow-up, but one of the big questions that any pediatrician, I think, who isn't in the ED a lot is always worried about is LP, your parents' LP, you know, and is that part of the diagnostic workup? When would you pull the trigger on some on blood work? What would the blood work be? And would you poke them in the spine?
So I think if you are concerned for sepsis, I think it makes sense to work up that baby. And if you look at the febrile infant guidelines that were published by the American Academy of Pediatrics, they obviously rely far more on the cultures rather than the inflammatory markers. And they do that because of the limited predictive value for even good inflammatory markers like procalcitonin for the presence of invasive bacterial infections. We have looked at trends in how these tests are being performed using the Children's Hospital Association data, that's multi-center pediatric hospital data. And we find that there is a huge interest in procalcitonin for hypothermic infants over the last 10 years. In addition to CRP, but really procalcitonin is really going up. And we know it has some predictive value for febrile infants. It's included in the guidelines by the American Academy of Pediatrics, especially in older infants over 21 days of age, where it has more predictive value. Nobody knows its value among young infants. Things like the absolute neutrophil count or white blood cell count have been demonstrated to have some correlation with the presence of bacterial infections in hypothermic infants. But similar to febrile infants, their value in isolation is very, very poor. You know, they have an area under the curve in the 0.6 to 0.7 range. We're not talking about a test that can really discriminate between a sick versus not sick infant. And so if you are going to use them, potentially they may have some value when combined with other clinical or physical examination predictors, but nobody knows what that formula really is. Some studies have also found some merit in the platelet count, actually, and with one study showing the value of a high platelet count, another study showing the opposite. So the data is all over the place with respect to the inflammatory markers. I think if you are sufficiently concerned that you want to work up the baby that's in front of you, it would make sense to get blood and urine cultures. The inflammatory markers you can get, but I personally would not decide to do something or not do something based on their value alone, since there's just so little data to sort of use them in any type of robust risk stratification algorithm.
It sounds like, especially in that early newborn period where hypothermia might be presenting more frequently and there's less evidence for those inflammatory markers. Is that right?
I think so. And then you also talked about lumbar puncture. That's tricky. I know that the trend for febrile infants is to get fewer and fewer of them over time. I don't think we can get a good answer on whether or not a baby of X age should get a lumbar puncture or not. This inverse correlation that we see in some studies with serious or invasive bacterial infections among slightly older infants compared to younger infants certainly gives me pause. I do think that if you are a slightly older baby and you have a low temperature, that is a little bit more concerning than if you are a two-day-old late preemie baby who's sort of small. And so my threshold to test and to treat would be higher in those infants. But again, that's guided by the evidence that's out there.
I'm actually going to flip this question the other way around, because we keep talking about, hey, if we're sick, you know, if you're concerned, if you're apneic, if you have these things, are you going to work them up for sepsis? The big question that we're all trying to figure out and is, you know, when do we not work up this kid and when do we do? So I'm going to frame it this way. When do you not work up a kid for infection? When do you not get blood cultures, urine cultures, CSF, you know, et cetera? Which kid there are you not going to do it for?
That is going to be an extremely hard question to answer. We know that most physicians are more likely to work up a baby. By work up, we're calling just a blood culture, just to, for the sake of argument, the baby that is younger and the baby that is colder. But even among those infants, a large number, maybe a fifth to a third, are not worked up. And those babies seem to have done fine. You know, we're not sending people to their graves. People are not coming back 2 days later with florid sepsis. So we're not missing a ton of babies either. So to me, that again speaks to that something that is telling clinicians that says, this baby's just fine. I do think that there is a correlation between having a lower temperature and having sepsis. So when you're talking about different definitions of hypothermia, I think that kind of warmer hypothermic infant in that 36 to 36.5 territory is probably fine. Most of those babies are not coming to the ED because of hypothermia. They're coming for something unrelated. and they happen to have a temperature that meets some criteria for hypothermia, those babies are probably lower risk, especially if that hypothermia does not persist. You know, you recheck it and it's fine 20 minutes later. I think that's probably okay. There was one study that suggested in a sample of approximately 200 infants that were referred to the ED from a primary care office with hypothermia, all of those babies were fine. There was not a single serious bacterial infection or case of herpes simplex virus infection, which we didn't talk about much in this podcast, but is another consideration for hypothermic infants. And so all of those babies were fine. So again, this goes back to that spidey sense of the clinician. If it's an isolated hypothermia, it seems like it disappeared. The baby looks fine in front of you. I think if you can get serial temperature measurements over the course of time and that they look fine, you're probably okay to not do anything further for that baby. But because that's not different from current practice right now. I think the challenge in current practice is potentially better identifying those sick patients so that you're not getting excessive workups on babies that don't need it.
Can I ask clarifying real quick, same thing, it sounds like the younger the baby, the more preterm the baby, the smaller the preterm the baby, almost the less worrisome an isolated hypothermia might be, because it's just considered temperature dysregulation as part of prematurity that we expect to improve as he feeds and grows and gets better. Is that accurate? Because that seems relatively unique in pediatrics to be like, oh, are they small, premature, and little? Then don't worry about it, right?
Yeah, it's like a yes, but type of question, because I think that age range is being flooded by these babies that are otherwise fine, but are just having a little bit of challenge with gaining weight. But the actual rate of sepsis is probably the same. It's just when you look at it in statistical models, that flooding out of otherwise healthy babies makes it a little bit harder to discern.
You just have a bigger denominator.
Exactly. And the cost of missing is higher too.
Sure.
So, and so I worry about that. Even if the baby looks fine, if they're 2 days old and hyperthermic, even if I can write it off to some other explanation in my head, I think, first of all, you might want to admit that baby anyways, because they can't maintain their thermoregulation irrespective of the presence of sepsis. So if you've already made that decision, one very high cost thing to miss would be sepsis. And so I don't think it's wrong to get a workup in that baby.
And this is really where the research is coming out. This is why we're trying to try to do it. Because right now you're like, you know, this seems lower, but I also can't miss it because it's going to be terrible if I do. So so I can see this is, I mean, this is the point of getting the data. The one question I was going to ask, you know, we kept mentioning isolated temperature and, oh, if it gets better, hey, if it's one off. I want to be a little bit more specific here. Like when, you know, you wrap the baby, how long, 30 minutes, an hour, 2 hours, you know, and then do I unwrap them again? And if they drop, is that then considered not real? You know, I'm trying to get like, what is a effective temperature warming that you wouldn't be concerned about versus what is what you would be concerned about?
To some extent, that might depend on the degree of hypothermia you've picked up, like 35.9, and then they rebundle and now they're 36.1, maybe less concerning than a more extreme swing in the temperatures that you're picking up. I don't think you'll ever hear anybody tell you a guideline that says bundle the baby for this long with this many layers of clothing and recheck the temperature so you can feel better about it. And no one's ever going to do that study either because it's too hard. So I think that's tough. It's very subjective, unfortunately. You know, I cited that study earlier that talked about how infants that were referred from the primary care clinic to the emergency department with hypothermia, like that historical hypothermia only, the patient was historically hypothermic in front of you, they are not. You can recheck the temperature as many times as you need for your satisfaction. That baby seems to be okay.
And that's great. And then the second piece to it, because this is what always comes up in the hospital, and sorry to go down this, but I feel like this is what happens to all of us, and so we might as well talk about it as a group. You know, the kid that gets put on the warmer, you know, so you don't bundle it, but the kid gets put on the warmer, you know, and then where are we at afterwards? And I'm getting the feeling that, you know what, we would all feel better by working this kid up. If, you know, if the kid goes on the warmer, even comes off the warmer and drops their temperature again, we'd work it up. How do you feel about the warmer versus clothes?
So if you really think it's a spurious temperature measurement, then the baby arguably does not need the warmer, right? So they're coming in front of you and they're either historically hypothermic or you get that one temperature under your watch that's hypothermic and then you choose to do nothing besides recheck the temperature maybe after rebundling, then you've chosen to not use the warmer in that situation. If you think the baby needs the warmer to maintain euthermia, then I think there's something going on there. You know, so I cited one previous 10 center study that looked at this among infants with hypothermia in multiple settings, and they found that this presence of repeated temperature instability is one risk factor, which seemed to pop out in their multivariable analysis. Challenging because it's hard to follow babies over time. And, you know, sepsis is something you want to work up at minute zero and not hour 12. But I think there's still something to be said about, like, if the temperatures are persistently low, something is off, or at least the risk of something being off is higher.
And not to continue to kind of go in the loop where I realize there's some just ambiguity, but we talked about, you know, then you need to work up the baby, or you work up the baby. And if you're having a CBC that's relatively normal, maybe, you know, inflammatory markers for whatever they're worth that are normal, and you have a blood culture cooking, how reassuring are those normal initial lab findings? And I ask because then the question is, if you have a normal CBC and inflammatory markers, are you saying, you know, I'm not worried about sepsis, or are you pulling the trigger on empiric antibiotic therapy while you're waiting for the blood culture? Is there a time, when in hypothermia are you considering empiric therapy for sepsis, which, knowing that that's going to be an ambiguous question, but what are the pros and cons?
Yeah, I mean, it's ambiguous. And I think, yeah, it's that's tricky. I don't know if I can give you a solid answer on that. I think the receiver operator characteristic curve performance of the white blood cell count, the absolute neutrophil count, there is some show that there is some association between those measures and the presence of an infection. But that strength of association is poor. And there is not a defined cutoff that would say this baby is quote unquote high risk versus low risk. Similar to the older febrile infant paradigms that existed with like the Philadelphia criteria and so forth. And for sure, nobody has looked at this with respect to CRP and procalcitonin in any big way, because those tests are more recent in terms of their availability in pediatric hospitals. And so the data is just not there. For all of these, are going to be some degree of ascertainment bias. If the ordering physician is getting a CBC and a procal, that means they're more worried about that baby than when they just discharged home. So there's that too. But arguably, you know, if you're worried enough to be sending a blood culture or a urine culture or an LP, I think it would make sense to just give empiric antibiotics. In the absence of any data that would suggest that these measures have strong predictive value with the presence of sepsis or not, you know, like it this is expert opinion, but I think if you're gonna do it, go all the way, and if you think it's fine, then you should own that too, which is tough, but I think that's the reality.
That makes a lot of sense.
And so I got a question about that, which I think is a good summary of kind of what we're getting at. Hey, when we're talking about workup, we're talking about infectious workup. If you're going to do the infectious workup, clearly there's no data to say, hey, just the CBC and inflammatory markers are enough. We barely have enough data for that for the febrile infant. We have so much more data than we do for the hypothermic infant. And it's all coming down, I feel like, to this, are you worried or are you not worried? And we've kind of come around this a couple times. But let's say, Steve, this case isn't really as vigorous as we described him before. Latch is poor, poor urine output or something like that. Like, as an expert emergency doctor, differentiate between the well-appearing and the unwell infant when we're talking about hypothermic infants.
Absolutely. So I think getting that information, getting history from the parents, as well as findings on your physical exam can be helpful. So starting with just the vital signs alone, we mentioned this before, but the degree of your hypothermia certainly has some association with the presence of serious infections, and then associated vital sign abnormalities. Is the child bradycardic or not? Usually we don't see that much tachycardia. So really it's the degree of bradycardia I think is going to be more concerning. Is the child breathing irregularly, or is there any concern for apneic spells? That's usually something that usually pops up more in history than it does on your examination. But if they're on the monitor, that might be something that you pick up with respect to the history. Concerns for feeding, I think, or listlessness or apnea or lethargy. I think we talked about this with the case report. These parents have known their child for one day. And so they have a poor baseline of what that might mean, especially if they're first time parents. And babies sleep a lot at baseline anyway. So I think that's tricky. But I think if they, to you who sees babies all day long, look like they're lethargic or listless, I think that should raise your level of concern for sure. You know, we mentioned this earlier, but several studies have shown that a high proportion, maybe at least half of babies with an invasive infection or a serious bacterial infection look abnormal during their physical examination. So those factors will certainly factor in. What's their perfusion like? Is the anterior fontanelle sunken? Do they look dehydrated on your physical exam? Do they have dry oral mucosa? Are their lips dry? Do they look just small for age? Like, do they have those excessive folds of skin that could be concerning that they're losing weight? What was their weight drop between their birth weight and their current weight today? I think those are all useful factors that can help you make that decision.
And maybe one other question to kind of, I think, wrap things to a close of what we've mentioned peripherally, HSV infection. Is HSV or any other type of bacterial or invasive or serious bacterial infection more associated with hypothermia?
So there is this classic association that HSV occurs more frequently in hypothermic infants than febrile infants. And there is some truth to that. There have been several series. HSV is one of those conditions that occurs so rarely that it's very, very hard to study these patients who have it to really identify risk factors. But several studies have suggested that the presence of hypothermia can be a risk factor for HSV. But a fraction of patients with HSV have euthermia, and a fraction of patients with HSV have fever too. So that makes it tricky. I think if you're in that higher risk age group for HSV, specifically really under the 2-week age frame, and they're hypothermic, I think if you're considering doing a workup, doing HSV is reasonable. If you're going to be doing testing for a serious bacterial infection, you should also be doing testing for HSV. Doing testing for HSV means getting a blood PCR for HSV and getting a spinal fluid PCR in addition to liver function tests and any surface swabs if you happen to find any. But, you know, there are babies with HSV who don't have any skin findings whatsoever. The AAP guidelines for febrile infants specifically point out getting HSV testing if the baby has hypothermia. That's the only mention of hypothermia that pops up in those guidelines, actually. So I think that also sort of supports doing HSV testing for these babies.
And then a last testing question, kind of before we make it to our next segment. We kind of talked, when we talked about differential diagnosis, we talked about kind of the major things being whether this is feeding temperature, prematurity, et cetera, whether this is infection, whether, you know, now we've talked about a whole bunch of different infections that it could possibly be. And then we did mention some of the other small things. Is there any test that you would send off the bat to test for anything else other than infection?
A blood sugar might be a good idea. If you're concerned about poor feeding in that little baby, they might be low enough that they actually have a concerningly low sugar. So that's usually one that you can get at the point of care. It's a good idea. I think we talked about checking a bilirubin, especially if they look jaundiced to you. I think that's reasonable. And especially since about a fifth of these babies have some degree of hyperbilirubinemia. Those might be useful sort of ancillary testing in addition to testing for serious infections or not. Whether or not a respiratory panel is of any benefit, I think the verdict is out there. A study was just published that really found that too few of those babies were getting a respiratory panel anyways for it to have any impact on whether or not it could be useful for the presence of any other infections. But we do see a decent number of infants who are ultimately diagnosed with bronchiolitis.
Hey, Cribsetters listeners. We've been talking about Freed for the last few weeks, and I thought I should give you a bit more of a background. So Freed is an AI scribe that listens, transcribes, and writes medical documentation for you. We've kind of told you that part already. But what's new is the background. So Gabby, a family medicine physician, and Erez, a computer engineer, came up with Freed, a solution that could help alleviate the daily burden of overworked clinicians everywhere. And for Erez, selfishly, it would mean that he could spend more time with Gabby, who was spending nights, weekends, and holidays updating medical documentation. Freed turns clinicians' daily workflow into accurate documentation instantly. There's no training time, no onboarding, no extra mental burden. All of the magic happens in just a few clicks. So clinicians can spend less energy on charting and more time on what they do best. Most importantly, Freed is HIPAA compliant. It learns your style over time, just like any human scribe. At $99 per month, more than 4,000 clinicians and their spouses have fallen in love with Freed. But good news, Cribsetters listeners, you can try Freed for free right now by going to freed.ai. And listeners of the Cribsetters podcast can use code CRIB50 for $50 off their first month. That's code CRIB50 for $50 off that first month.
Maybe just to kind of bring it all back together again, so, you know, for our listeners who are in the clinic, they're seeing hypothermia pretty persistently. They're feeling that they recognize there's these risks of missing something severe. So they refer to the ED, like in our patient. If you're the peds ED person who's just had a patient referred in, what are we doing here?
I think, you know, the hypothermia was observed in another setting, like the primary care physician's office. The patient was referred in for that problem. They appear to be hypothermic in the vitals that you're getting here. I think that raises enough concern in this baby, even in the absence of other things, to me that I would want to work them up to look for that more serious bacterial infection. It sounds like, again, they could not maintain euthermia. We've proven that at this point. And so a longer period of observation is necessary, irrespective of the presence of a serious infection. I think discharge to home at this point, at least off the bat, is not going to happen, at least if I was taking care of this baby. So it would make sense to me to additionally look for any other potentially serious causes of that hypothermia. you know, if they were hypothermic in the primary care physician's office and then they're not hypothermic in front of you, I might be less inclined to do that. But if they really are hypothermic in both the settings, I think that pushes me towards doing the testing.
And if they're looking good, normal vitals in the ED, maybe watch them take a couple more readings and then feel more comfortable discharge to home. Or even then, would you maybe observe if they were confirmed temperature unstable on the outpatient setting?
If they're only historically hypothermic and they're not hypothermic for you to your satisfaction, they're feeding well, you have no concerns about their weight gain, maybe you've checked over the course of a 2 or 3 hour period and you maybe have that conversation with the primary care doctor, I think that warm handoff is really good and essential for these just to make sure that everyone's on the same page. I think you could discharge home.
I think we were wondering whether you have an idea of like the prevalence of this type of situation showing up.
So most of the research that's been done on this, that is to say all of the research that's been done on this, has been done at children's hospitals. And children's hospitals are not the setting where most kids get their care, right? We only know it's about, where about 5 to 20% of kids go to seek their care in the emergency department. From my personal experience doing this research as a fellow in Pittsburgh, I had this big data set that we curated of infants who got a blood culture. And we had about 360 hypothermic infants and almost 3,000 febrile infants. So from that, I got the sense that hypothermia occurs about 1/10 as frequently as fever. That was my sense. Another study that has looked at this a little bit more rigorously was reported by Kazmaier and colleagues, and they found that hypothermia occurred approximately 1/4 as frequently as fever.
Those are great pearls. And I, you know, it seems like this is a very novel field, but just to throw out there, we always try to see if there's health disparities and understand health disparities in the field. Is there any obvious racial or gender or other types of disparities in the field of hypothermic infants?
Nobody has done research into this space. And so I think that is an interesting question that you raise. If I were to hazard a guess, I would suspect that hypothermia probably presents in rates that are similar to those of prematurity. And we know that there are disparities in prematurity by race and ethnicity and socioeconomic status. And so my guess would be that hypothermia corresponds to that. Now, whether or not infants with hypothermia are treated differently based on race and ethnicity or socioeconomic status or other indicators is sort of an unanswered question. There's been some fantastic research about this with febrile infants that's been published recently that demonstrates disparities in the care of older febrile infants based on race and ethnicity, but that sort of research has not been touched in hypothermia.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. You know, I think it's a good time to get to our take-home points, and not that I'm the presenter at all, but I just wanted to say that it's really important just to talk about this, whether there's good data or not good data for every single one of these kids for this. You know, this is a burgeoning field, and that we all have these questions as doctors, like, what am I doing with this cold baby that just showed up in my clinic or my emergency room, or my hospital? And I feel a lot better having talked about this and maybe saying, hey, I don't know all the pieces, but I feel a lot better just knowing that, hey, we all don't know, and this is what we're going to do together, and we're basing it on some of these things. So to take that into your main take-home points, what are we basing these things off? What should our listeners know, and what should we take away?
Absolutely. So I think you've sort of hit some of those key points, which is that we still don't know a lot about hypothermic young infants and how we should best take care of them. And everyone seems to be a little bit puzzled about this. It's something I get asked about frequently, or that comes up a lot in national conferences, like, what about the hypothermic infant? And then nobody seems to know what to do. Mm. And the research remains limited, even though I have been involved in this and a lot of that research is my own. I acknowledge that there's big gaps here that cannot be answered with the existing research that's underway. I think a big take-home message remains, get comfortable with examining babies and get a good sense of which babies you are most concerned about and which ones you think are okay. Because I think that gestalt, despite its limitations, still has some value in this space. I also think it's totally okay to do the more conservative approach, given what's known out there, and that it's, you know, in the interest of keeping babies safe, it's totally fine to be more conservative, even if other people raise their eyebrows at what you're doing. You know, do what's right for the patient.
Beautiful. This has been so wonderful. We are so appreciative of your expertise and your time. Is there anything that we should send our listeners to? Anything you'd like to plug or resources that our listeners might like to check out?
Sure. So I just, first of all, would like to plug the Gerber Foundation, which has been sponsoring a lot of the work that I'm doing at hypothermic young infants. So I'm very grateful to their support for my work. We're also doing a multi-center study using the Pediatric Emergency Medicine Collaborative Research Committee to further our knowledge of hypothermic young infants. So I'm excited to see what comes out of that research.
Amazing. We're going to keep our eyes peeled for that type of work. Shout out to the Gerber Foundation for supporting your work. We're very grateful for them because we're very grateful for you. This has been phenomenal. Lots of great pearls. Our listeners are going to love it. Thank you for your time, and thanks for coming on to the Cribsiders.
Thanks for having me. This has been fun.
The number you have dialed has been changed. The new number is...
This has been another episode of the Cribsiders.
It's for the kids.
Get show notes and sign up for our weekly Knowledge Food Formula Feeds newsletter on our website at www.thecribsiders.com.
We're committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge, and to do that, we need your feedback. Please subscribe, rate, and review the show at on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, whatever you got. You can contact us at thecribsiders@gmail.com, thecribsiders@gmail.com. Call us anytime. A special thanks to our producer for this episode, Dr. Sam Mazur, our showrunner for this episode and all episodes, Dr. Sam Mazur, and our wonderful social media team on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Be sure to give us a like. I've been Justin Lee Burke.
I've been Sam Mazur.
And this has been Chris the Chimanchu. Thank you and good afternoon. And for those who have stuck around to the end, here is your gift, a poem written by AI. In the hush of the clinic under fluorescent lights glow, a neonate arrives with warmth running low. The chill of the world, a stark sudden blow, in the arms of a caregiver, concern starts to show. Quick, let's wrap this small life in our care with blankets and love. Warmth from despair. With a thermometer's beep in the crisp, sterile air, reveals hypothermia's presence laid bare. The pediatrician moves with swift, gentle... The pediatrician moves with swift, gentle grace, a radiant warmer in this chilly place. Kangaroo care, a tender embrace, brings heat to the cheeks of that tiny face. Fluids warm and glucose to feed, for energy's fire against cold's cruel greed. In careful watch, the team leads, guiding the infant, their warmth to succeed. In this quiet office where healing hands meet, a battle against cold in defeat. For every neonate, a warmth so sweet, in the embrace of care, their hearts beat. See you guys.